I'm Bill Giddings from Pacific Lutheran University, where I teach environmental science. And over the past quite a few years, I've become more and more interested in the atmosphere and the way that things interact there. So today, we're here to talk about the greenhouse effect. And first, a good word for the greenhouse effect. It's one thing that is responsible for the earth being habitable for life as we know it. It's the presence of trace amounts of gases in the atmosphere, along with the nitrogen and oxygen that make up 99% of it. These trace gases help to keep the globe's average temperature some 55 degrees warmer than it would be without them. And considering that life as we know it depends primarily on processes in liquid water inside us as well as in the oceans, then that temperature range is necessary for the way things are. We recognize that the only major import this earth has is solar energy. And the only major export from this earth is heat back out into the rest of the universe. And unless the total amount of energy coming in as primarily visible light from the sun is balanced by an equal amount of heat energy radiating back out, then the average temperature on the earth has got to change one way or the other anytime the process is out of balance. Of the sunlight that is aimed at the earth, about a quarter of it is reflected back off the atmosphere from clouds and dust up there. Another quarter of it is absorbed by particles and molecules in the atmosphere and help warm it up. About 5% reflected off the surface of the earth, and the other 45% soaks in and is changed into heat energy. So that adds up to 30% of sunlight bouncing back out, and so 70% of the incoming energy has to go out as heat, and the form of energy that carries heat is called infrared radiation. Now, of course, as talked about some on Monday, there's a complex exchange of heat in between the land, the water, and the air, but that doesn't change the overall balance unless there's a change in the amount that the atmosphere either reflects back, soaks up itself, or lets out in the form of heat. And this infrared light, otherwise on its way out, is absorbed mainly by two kinds of molecules in the atmosphere: water and carbon dioxide. Chemists find that writing all those syllables gets too tedious, and so we have a kind of shorthand. CO2 means exactly carbon, one of them, di to oxide, two oxygens. So that's the molecule that we'll be most concerned with this afternoon, because after all, we recognize that water mainly goes round and round between liquid on the earth, vapor in the air, clouds that form, rain and snow, ice and oceans. And so the amount in the air is somewhat self-limiting. If too much gets there, it comes back down again. Although, of course, the amount in the air varies a lot as the humidity varies from time to time and place to place. Precise measurements of the amount of carbon dioxide in the air have been taken since the late 1950s on top of Mauna Loa, the big island of Hawaii, where there's thousands of miles of Pacific Ocean downwind of any major source of carbon dioxide. So those measurements are taken to represent the average in the air in the northern hemisphere, because the exchange of air across the equator is very slow and things can be different down south. This level of carbon dioxide in our air has gone up more than 10% since 1960. And it's estimated, that's by actual measurement, and it's been estimated from evidence in the ice sheets and so forth, that there's been a 30% increase in just the past 125 years of industrialization around the world. Now, carbon dioxide gets into the air naturally as vegetation decays, and from volcanoes and forest fires as individual events. And carbon dioxide is taken up out of the air by plants as they grow in the process called photosynthesis. Now, when we burn wood as to heat the buildings in the winter here at Holden Village, all the carbon dioxide that the tree took up when it grew is released back into the air in a short period of time. If the tree falls in the forest and rots, the same amount of carbon dioxide is released, but much more slowly. So, as long as trees are growing and being used and decaying at the same rate, that's no net change. However, when we burn what we call fossil fuels, coal, oil, and natural gas, then the carbon in those puts extra carbon dioxide that hasn't been in the air, at least recently. And when deforestation takes place on the earth faster than regrowth, then again more carbon dioxide is put into the air than was there before that process. Now, about half the extra carbon dioxide that's been going into the air dissolves in the ocean, and the other half stays in the air, more or less. There are still arguments between oceanographers and biologists over whether the total amount that is in living plants on the Earth's surface is getting greater or smaller. The oceanographers tell the biologists there must be more plants than there were because they can't find the carbon dioxide in the ocean, and the biologists tell the oceanographers that they can't find it on the land either, but it's going somewhere. More recently, it's been realized that this carbon dioxide that can soak up heat that would otherwise radiate out to space actually amounts to only about two-thirds, and in the future perhaps only about half, of the possible global warming problem. There are several other gases that are called greenhouse gases because they have the same effect of soaking up heat and warming the earth, and their total effect together may add up as their, if they continue to increase, to give as much effect as the carbon dioxide. So one of these other greenhouse gases is called methane, and the chemical shorthand telling us what's in that is CH4. Another one is called nitrous oxide, which adds up to, in counting atoms, N2O, and another category of molecules are what are called chlorofluorocarbons, which is a very long word that we can draw a much simpler picture to represent. C for carbon, carbon atoms hooked to four other atoms. And fluoro means there is a chlorine atom attached to the carbon. Fluoro means there is a fluorine atom attached to the carbon. And as long as you've got both of those, it fits this definition regardless of what the other two are. Methane gets into the air by natural processes. Whenever plants decay where oxygen from the air can't get at them to form the carbon dioxide, then the carbon comes off with hydrogen and methane. And that takes place in wetlands It takes place in rice paddies, which are underwater where the growth is taking place. It takes place in the guts of cattle and termites, and these are main contributors to the increased amount of methane that's been building up. In fact, its concentration has more than doubled, while the carbon dioxide concentration has gone up 30% since the Industrial Revolution, and the methane concentration is increasing at 1% a year. Other sources of methane from human activity include from coal mines, from natural gas — it is natural gas — which may leak out of oil wells and pipelines. It also forms in garbage landfills, and from incomplete burning in processes like land clearing. The nitrous oxide is produced also by agricultural burning, and apparently by over-fertilization. If there's more nitrogen put into the soil than the plants can use, the extra can come out in this form. And its rate of increase is also much more rapid than that of the carbon dioxide. The chlorofluorocarbons we used to use to push the spray out of all our spray cans. We don't use it for that in the United States anymore, but they do in many other countries. It's still being used in plastic foams. It's being used in refrigerators and air conditioners, in fire extinguishers, and as cleaning solvents in the electronics industry. The amounts in the air have been rising 5% a year for that. And although the level of it is much, much lower than the natural carbon dioxide in the air, each molecule of the chlorofluorocarbons is 10,000 times as efficient at trapping heat as a molecule of carbon dioxide. Now, that part of the problem may be the first one that will be successfully addressed, because those are the same molecules that have a different kind of effect on the ozone layer, which I'll talk about on Saturday. And I think it would be more confusing than helpful to say anything about that problem today, other than the same things contributing to it, and the concern about the other problem is leading to international agreements to phase these out, which will cut back on their contribution to this problem as well. So our concern about the greenhouse effect is about global warming and what that may do to human and other life on Earth. But we can't even know if the Earth is getting warmer or not unless we can take its average temperature. How are we going to do that? How do you find the average temperature over all the Earth? You can't use just one thermometer. You've got to try to measure it. You can't measure it everywhere, but take all the measurements you have and average them and try to figure out what the rest of it's doing where you aren't measuring. Well, where do you take most of your measurements? Where people are. Where are most people? Obviously on land and not on the ocean, even though 2/3 of the Earth is covered with ocean. We don't have nearly so many measurements there. Majority of the land is in the northern hemisphere, so that's where most of the measurements are taken. And based on those measurements, it's been considered that the Earth's temperature had been increasing from 1880 to 1940 or so, and then started dropping for a while. But then some other people have said, wait a minute, we don't have complete enough information. Those measurements at the higher latitudes of the southern hemisphere, the ones we have from Australia, New Zealand, and Antarctica, seem to be showing exactly the opposite trend. So we may not be sure even what the average temperature of the Earth is now and has been in recent years, let alone figure out exactly what's going to be. And in fact, as I went through my files to pull out the articles to pull together for this session, I found I'd collected quite a few of them 10 to 15 years ago when there was a whole lot of excitement over the cooling of the Earth and the possible onset of another ice age. Now, in 1988-89, newspapers, magazines, full of articles about possible disaster from global warming of the greenhouse effect. How can we change our worries that fast? Well, I have a nice little picture here. I'll sketch bigger on here to try to give some idea if this is the Earth's temperature average in 1880 as best we know it, and go over to 1990 over here, which is almost upon us. There's a lot of ups and downs from year to year. We all have lived enough years to be familiar with that. So things bounce up and down, but up to, this is 1940, tend to bounce up more than they bounce down, then some ups and downs from there to about 1965, bounce around a bit, and then some upswings again to about 1980. So if you're looking on a 100-year scale and you say, well, we'll just smooth this out on the average, sure enough, we seem to be going up, and up something on the order of a degree in that length of time. But of course, if you look on a 20-year scale, sure enough, we've turned the corner and they're sliding down here, unless you wait another 10 or 15 years and it looks like we've turned another corner and are sliding up there, but maybe we're just bouncing around again with bigger and bigger bounces. We really don't know yet. And of course, there are other factors besides these greenhouse gases that are important in controlling the temperature of the Earth. Especially important are particles, dust, smoke, clouds, volcanic ash in the air, which can shade the Earth, bounce some of the sunlight back before it ever gets in to become heat. So it really is unclear to most scientists whether the fact that out of the last 10 years, it includes 5 of the hottest years since temperature records have been taken, really means that the greenhouse effect is here and showing up. Last summer, as 45 cities in the country topped 100 degrees on the same day, and over the course of the summer, I think we visited half of them, Dr. James Hansen of NASA told a United States Senate committee that there isn't one chance in 100 of having 5 hottest years on record within the last 10 without a greenhouse effect or something like it. This spring, he was testifying again to Congress in warning about the dangers and suggesting that it's time to do some hard thinking and take some action. And of course, they always pre-print their text and release it to the newspapers before they actually say it. But it turns out that the White House Office of Management and Budget changed his text for him to make it look like things aren't as bad as he said. I believe what he said to Congress was what he intended to say. And Senator Gore and some others had some pretty pointed remarks about that kind of practices. Well, most scientists in the field say, for reasons like this, you can't say yet that it is happening, because there's going to take a lot more evidence than that. But Dr. Hansen happens to have the most elaborate computer model in the world to address climate, and that, of course, is the only way you can project what is going to happen, is by setting up a model, a deliberate oversimplification. You know it's not going to be right, because reality has too much complexity to it to put into mathematical equations precisely, but you hope it's at least going to give you accurate ideas of what the trends are. Well, why is he worried? Why is warmer a problem, except we may be more uncomfortable? The computer models show that within the next 100 to 200 years, depending on a great deal on what the people of the Earth choose to do in that length of time, that the global temperature could, and likely will, at least by the end of that 200 years, rise to a higher average temperature than any time in the last over 100,000 years. A higher temperature than any time since human civilization, let alone since any records were taken. And so there's no history to compare what that effect of that climate change can be. And that's only maybe 5 degrees higher than now, to be warmer than ever, as far as any human record, and warmer than any time since between 2 or 3 ice ages ago. The last ice age was only 10 degrees cooler than the present average temperature. Well, computer models are used to predict what that will do to the weather and climate patterns. Obviously, warmer will mean longer growing season in some areas. Could be beneficial. But warmer will also mean drier in some other areas. And those of you from the Midwest last summer will recognize that warmer and drier can spell disaster. In fact, most of the models predict that under this scenario, the Midwest would become a desert. And now, of course, it is the largest source of exportable food for the world market on Earth. They predict that there will be more severe storms and more extreme hot and cold, more and bigger up and down waves on the upward trend, giving more severe flooding and more severe drought. Even if areas like Canada and Siberia get a better growing season and even more rainfall, they have poorer soil and may not be able to substitute for the present grain belt becoming desert. Even now, fluctuations of rainfall and periodic droughts that are like they have been in recorded history in areas of Africa bring starvation to peoples there. Now, as far as our west coast of the United States, a milder climate would mean less snow and more of the precipitation as rain in the winter. That would mean more winter floods, less irrigation water and electric power in the summer, because it's the snowpack staying and melting slowly that gives us those capabilities. Unquestionably, some places would be better off and other places would be worse off, and there is no model that you can count on to tell you which place will get better and which place will get worse. Well, another thing to consider, after all, plants use carbon dioxide to grow. More carbon dioxide would mean faster plant growth. That's true. However, those plants that grow faster, and you can do these experiments, just close them up and pump in more carbon dioxide, those plants that grow faster have more fiber and less protein. You get more of it, but less nutrition for what you get. So that, and they change their the form of their output when they're stressed by conditions that they're not used to. Another very serious concern is that, of course, if the average temperature rises, then the glaciers and the polar ice caps will get smaller. That means there will be more water in the oceans and the sea level will rise. And of course, as the water in the oceans gets warmer, it expands anyway, whether there's more of it being poured in or not. One third of the world's population now lives near sea level, close enough so that it's possible that their lives would be completely disrupted by this kind of a change. It's not that overnight they'd be drowned in their beds, but if you have to move a third of the world's population over a 100-year period, that is going to be extremely difficult to find resources to do. And already, as land is sinking because they've been pumping out oil and water underneath it, for example, or as geological processes are tilting things a bit, and the sea level has actually been rising a few inches over the last 100 years, cities are running into trouble already with rising sea levels and sinking lands. London, Tokyo, Osaka, Bangkok, Shanghai, Miami, Houston, New Orleans, Los Angeles already have these problems. Add another few feet of water, a 3-foot rise would cover 1/6 of the land area of Bangladesh. It would destroy the agricultural capability of 1/5 of the fertile land of Egypt. It would completely cover the Marshall Islands, the Maldives Islands, and some others in the Caribbean. And if it's not a 3-foot rise, but a greater rise that some scenarios had considered within the realm of possibility, the whole state of Florida could end up underwater. Now, there are many uncertainties in these models. We know that. Especially uncertain are the effects of clouds and oceans on the climate to come. And so I can only suggest examples of some other complications that we don't know, nobody knows yet what to expect about. There are other processes that can happen along with this that can amplify the process and make it worse, or damp it down and make it not so bad, or even change direction. So here's a scenario for what we call positive feedback. A change comes around and feeds on itself and makes a bigger change, which makes more change in the same direction. Just like if the loudspeaker feeds into the microphone and you get that ear-splitting sound. As the ice melts, then less sunlight will be reflected back, because ice is the best at reflecting sunlight. More will be soaked up, because water is the best at absorbing sunlight as heat. That means that more warming will melt more ice, and the cycle will feed on itself. Add to that, a warmer ocean can dissolve less carbon dioxide, and that's where half the extra is going. Add to that that if the Arctic permafrost melts, then what now is essentially inactive in this process will become a tremendous source of methane, a very potent greenhouse gas, as wetlands are. More greenhouse effect, more in the same direction. But if you don't like that one, let's try a negative feedback, where the reaction to the process actually pushes back in the opposite direction. As the ocean gets warmer, what happens? Well, more water will evaporate. As more water evaporates and rises and cools, more of it will condense. We'll get more cloud cover. More cloud cover will bounce more light back and have a cooling effect, and also, of course, give more rain and more snow up in the Arctic regions. More snow in the Arctic regions expands the glaciers, magnifies the cooling effect, and, strange as it may seem, a global warming could turn around and trigger another ice age. So we're not sure whether we're coming or going here. Well, what should we do about it if we decide it's, after all, worth worrying about? One article said the only way to eliminate the problem would be to return the world to its pre-industrial state And I don't think even any of us at Holden Village are ready to recommend that. Last summer in Toronto, 48 countries sent 300 delegates that were worried enough about it to go to an international conference on the changing atmosphere. And what they say we ought to do about it is to have a 20% reduction in the carbon dioxide released from the industrialized nations by the year 2005. And to get this reduction by conservation, making better use of the energy we have, not wasting so much, and by shifting to alternative energies away from burning fuels. That 20% reduction is intended to give some latitude for further development in the developing areas. However, it would need a 50% reduction in the amount of CO2 that places like the United States put out just to keep the level the same as it is now. So that wouldn't solve the problem by itself. Actually, to the extent we could switch from coal and oil to natural gas, methane, has hydrogen with it, and so you get twice as much energy for the same amount of carbon dioxide if you burn natural gas instead of coal. But you still get carbon dioxide. If deforestation could be reduced, if trees could be grown at least as fast as they're being cut, then at least you wouldn't be making the problem worse. Wood is, of course, the significant energy source for two-thirds of the population in developed countries. Not going to be easy to do. At another conference in Boulder, Colorado this year, a delegate from Jamaica said in regard to what's going on there, they're cutting down more trees to grow more coffee to sell to us to help pay off their debts. He says, "We know what we're doing cannot be sustained environmentally. But what are our choices? If deforestation is so important, couldn't forgiving the debts of developing nations be seen as an investment?" And of course, the same logic would apply many times over to Brazil, which has the largest debt and the largest area of currently progressing deforestation. Well, planting more trees, one article said that to overcome the greenhouse effect of the carbon dioxide as things are going, you'd need to plant enough new forest to cover Australia. And that's not going to happen easily or soon. But at least if the direction can be changed, then things, if they get worse, will get worse more slowly. Per person, we in the United States contribute 5 tons a year of carbon dioxide. That's not what we breathe out, that's on our behalf. Per person in China, 4/10 of a ton, less than 10% as much. China, however, plans to double its coal production in the next 15 years. China's goal is to increase their per capita income from its present $100 or $200 a year clear up to being a level 15% as high as ours. That's their goal. They're not likely to say, well, we'll give up that goal and quit burning coal. That's what they have. And of course, they have so many more people that even at a low per capita production of carbon dioxide, the increase that they have planned will be as much as our whole amount that we put out now. More per person, less people. Last year, Jaromir Nemec, Chief of Water Resources for the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, said, "The risk is too large not to look for possible alternatives and means of mitigation, even if the search is based on predictions with a large margin of error. Forecasting is a dangerous game. Blind and passive waiting for a possible disaster is even more dangerous." So I would agree with those that suggest this is one more good reason to do some things we know we should be doing anyway, for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is
economic justice and environmental preservation, and that the sooner we start, the more effective the action would be. But I would like to challenge you to suggest to me what kinds of actions, assuming you believe this is worth worrying about, for the sake of argument at least, what kind of actions would you be willing to take personally, would you urge that the United States take as a matter of policy and try to persuade other nations? Yes, sir.
The first thing is to convince my wife that she could live with 70 degrees instead of 72.
Well, I won't make any projections on how easy or difficult that would be.
What effect would, this may be a little off, not in response to your question, but what effect would nuclear power have on the carbon dioxide production?
Well, nuclear power does not burn carbon. However, mining uranium, milling it, processing it, transporting it does. So before you get the electrical energy back out, you're investing some carbon dioxide. So
it's not. Has there been a study to determine if it would be feasible as to the amount of carbon dioxide be used in the milling, the mining, and the manufacturing of uranium?
Well, the one article I read that dealt with that said that it's not entirely clear whether you would actually save any or use just as much. But even assuming you do save it, and your goal is to replace all the generating capacity on Earth that now burns coal and petroleum with nuclear power plants, you would have to build a new nuclear power plant every day for 40 years to do that. So the direction may be to reduce it, but the total magnitude is you can't depend on that as the answer. Mm-hmm. Well, I'd submit that when it comes to energy, you better not depend on anything as the answer. You're going to need a whole lot of things working in the same direction. And that's going to be a difficult direction to turn to now based on the history of the last 10 years.
Well, when you alluded to an alternate type of fuel which would produce less carbon dioxide, to what were you referring?
Well, if, for example, fuel cells can be developed rather than burning.
You mean battery?
No, something which, battery gives a chemical reaction involving primarily metals to give electrons. Mm-hmm. Well, fuel cells are used, for example, on satellites, spacecraft, where the fuel is still combined with oxygen, but you don't burn it in a flame, use that to boil water, and that to drive a turbine to make electricity.
You're not really speaking of solar energy.
Well, not yet. Okay. I'm talking about fuel cells using fossil fuels, but the energy of using a steam cycle, dynamo type of power production, is between 25% and 30% of the energy that goes in as fuel comes out as electricity, and that's just by the physical nature of using heat to do mechanical work. No way around that. A fuel cell can give 50% to 70% energy return as electricity just by doing the same thing in a completely different physical process, chemical process. So that would help a lot, but a lot more development would be needed. Solar energy has cut the cost of electricity generated that way by a factor of at least 100 in the last 20 years from what it was then. And whether the solar energy industry is a flourishing small industry or one that is not, has that change has been made by one change in government policy, whether you give them tax breaks or don't. And of course, the nuclear power industry has received far much more government subsidy than all other forms of energy together. So it would be only reasonable to give some of the same kinds of advantages to solar, and it could do a lot. Conservation can mean things like in buildings. 15 years ago, the American Institute of Architects said if we just could do what they already would do, what they already knew how to do, that would be cheaper than continuing to do what we've been doing. Could save about as much energy as our domestic oil production provides now. We've done some. We haven't done near what we could, but of course you got to pay for it up front, and you get the benefit over the years. So there's economic, political, social problems in doing that.
How do you account for the decrease in carbon dioxide in the 1940s?
This is the average temperature.
Well, that was average temperature.
And that was being accounted for by either a natural cycle, since this was more favorable than warm, I should say, not necessarily favorable, but warmer than it had been for Roman Empire times, or increased junk going into the air, and that's cooling effect. There are other hands back here. Yes.
Significant practical use of propane.
I can't quite hear.
Practical is the use of propane to power cars.
Well, propane to power cars has received its main attention for other reasons, namely that of air pollution. It burns a lot cleaner than gasoline.
So it's carbon dioxide.
The only impractical thing about it is that instead of a convenient liquid you can carry in a lightweight tank and just pump in through a nozzle, you have to have a pressurized tank, which weighs more, takes more space, and mechanics of supplying it are more difficult. But there are a lot of propane-powered vehicles that are used for delivery trucks, for buses, yeah, in urban areas where it's especially important to cut down on the air pollution. So it's a direction that would help to some extent. You get a lot of the energy in propane from burning the hydrogen as well as the carbon. It's sort of between gasoline and natural gas in that regard. It wouldn't help as much as switching coal-fired power plant to natural gas, for example. But again, it would be a step in that direction, which there are other reasons also for being interested in.
Two things. One is, okay, my daughter happens to be in the nuclear chemistry business.
Uh-huh.
And she keeps telling me what she's hearing is that the biggest problem they have is what to do with the waste.
That has not yet been decided.
They're more worried about that right now than a lot of other things. They are saying, some of the people who are thinking are saying that at the rate they're going, they will have an answer. It's going to take time, but they will have an answer on how to destroy it. But the other side of it is that I live in an area where the soft coal is mined.
Mm-hmm.
And I know soft coal isn't worth a ding up in the heavens. And when I was talking about Chicago's buses, I remember when all this railroad trains used to sit there all day long and all day long.
Right.
And when I was growing up, 11 o'clock in the morning before you saw the sun, there was that big blurb up in the heavens if the wind didn't blow in the wintertime.
Right.
Everybody was burning soft coal, Pittsburgh and on and on.
London, same thing.
Yeah, and if it's true that acid rain is giving our Canadian friends fits, as well as Wisconsin and Michigan and New Hampshire and Vermont,
mm-hmm,
then it just seems to me
For what it's worth, the government ought to say pretty soon, hey guys, we're going to cut that acid rain right down. We're going to go to natural gas or whatever the alternative is. And have to do it. Because the water, beside killing the fish, is of no use to anybody, is it? Doesn't the water, I hate it, sour is the best definition I can. Doesn't the water be right. Sour in these lakes?
Yeah, some of them are beautifully blue because they're completely dead. Nothing living in them. And the whole eastern half of the United States, and especially up the Ohio Valley, but the whole eastern half of the United States is getting the damaging effects of that. So again, there are more reasons than the greenhouse effect to try to move in the same directions. But that's certainly another one.
But it's not when you ask what we could do individually. I'm sorry, you didn't.
Go ahead.
Hey, it's one of the dreams, maybe it's a fantasy I've heard, is that you use solar power to generate electricity and make hydrogen out of water, and you have a hydrogen fuel economy. Hydrogen makes no carbon dioxide at all, and that's clearly something that's in dream stage. But some people are there. I think there's actually society promoting a hydrogen economy, a hydrogen fuel economy, as the answer to problems.
Right, and it would take some technology we don't have yet, of course, to do that. And especially if the hydrogen could be used in a fuel cell rather than a flame-burning heat-type engine, then that would be much better. And hydrogen can be piped around as natural gas is piped around. It tends to leak more easily than natural gas, but it's just the same general sorts of systems would need to be used. And for automobiles, again, propane or natural gas is also used in some vehicles. Hydrogen could be used in much the same way if the car was built for that from the beginning. Yeah.
We're from Portland, and we just put in a new metro bus, or it's a Tunerville trolley.
Yeah, I've seen it.
It has kept a lot of cars out of downtown Portland.
Mm-hmm.
And I think mass transportation would be one answer to some of our problems.
Yeah, the Seattle-Tacoma corridor is talking about it, some people seriously, others not so seriously.
This has been very successful in Portland, and they're thinking about putting it on the other side of the city.
It's another of these things where you've got to put the money up front and get the benefits from then on.
Pittsburgh has gone to that. One of the reasons they went to that is because they were remembering what it was like when they used to call it the Golden Triangle. And this is no exaggeration. I stood on a train in the Pennsylvania Railroad Yard, and the train went by on the next track, and I never saw that train. I asked the brakeman, I said, where's that train? He says, 3 feet. And it was that foggy. I said, is it always like this? And he says, oh, this is Pittsburgh. And he says, smoke capital of the world. But Pittsburgh, when they pushed for the new light rail, or whatever they call it, they said they would take so many buses off the street. And people said, okay, the heck with the buses, we'll run these trolleys. Now, they got to still make the electrical power. But the electrical power may be made in Steubenville or down the river somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Where it's being made anyway. But if you go to Chicago, this mass transportation system, and get out on the interstate, and when they got 8 lanes of traffic in the morning that are just plugged up, and in the middle aisle are these 8-car trains that are doing 50 and 60 miles an hour, I don't understand why anybody drives in Chicago. Good heaven, beside the CO2 that's coming up in your face and all the rubber that the cars are burning on the road, it just doesn't make any sense.
Well, I'm going to be on sabbatical leave next year and doing some research at the University of Washington. That's about 40 miles away from where I live. But of course, at rush hour, that's 1.5 to 2 hours each way of gridlock. So we're moving to Seattle for the year. I'm going to spend half a work day sitting in a traffic jam where I can take the bus to work. Yes.
So you asked a while ago what I as an individual could do, or you alluded to the fact that what we individually could do to help alleviate this problem. And this problem here with the coal is something that each of us could have some effect on if we just start lobbying our congressmen. At the same time, when lobbying to take the subsidy off of tobacco farmers, make ourselves real popular, that's one thing that we can do.
Well, it's alleged that automobiles that get upwards of 50 miles to a gallon have been developed, but people don't want to drive something that small and weak, I guess.
What if we get the coal industry killed back into natural gas? That helps solve the problem there. That's a great problem, too.
Am I not right that the coal that you get out in the West basically is low sulfur?
Yep.
Compared to what we get in Ohio, Illinois, and Indiana.
That's correct. Along with that, it's somewhat lower in heat value, so you have to burn more of it. But still, it's much less source of sulfur acid. And the western coal is strip mined, which is a lot safer than the underground mines, and tears up the countryside, which may or may not be possible to regenerate depending on the availability of water. And we know that mining can have some visible effect on the landscape. Well, I think that it's probably time to call an official halt to this so that those of us who want to go to first dinner can make it. And I thank you for your participation.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.